gravity. And one of the things that bothered me when I started learning about it is that, at least at first sight, the affinite value of the Emirti parameter breaks parity. So I tried to find out a little about that. This is the paper. My views on this have evolved a little since the writing. So I'll tell you first a few simple analytical facts about parity invariance of the full vertex amplitude. First, to see what happens to it if we flip the sign of gamma. And then I'll propose a parity-like operator, which commutes with the vertex, but I think can really be called parity only when gamma goes to zero. And then I'll tell you about some analytic, some numerical results about the large spin four simplex limit, where Eugenio has done a lot of good work. So I learned my stuff from reading Rovelli and Barrett. So these are the two definitions of the Lorentzian vertex that I'm comfortable with. Just to have them handy. Okay, so integrate over SL2C at the nodes. And then there's the link propagator, which in terms of SU2 variables at the links, we can write with the group characters. And in terms of semi-coherent states with the spin and source and target spinners at each link, so integrate over spinner Z. And now the first question of the day, for which I couldn't find an answer, so far I'm under the assumption that what I'm going to say is original, is whether the amplitude for gamma is the same as the amplitude for minus gamma. Okay, and since in the vertex formula, gamma seems to be the only possible source for parity violation, this is more or less equivalent to the question, is the dynamics parity invariant? In addition to that, we have the question of whether the kinematics is parity invariant, the geometric interpretation of the boundary state. And the answer to this is yes. So first of all, in the Euclidean case, this is more obvious. Because in the Euclidean case, we're dealing with representations of SO4, which are of this kind. And flipping the sign of gamma simply means interchanging the two. And their roles are exactly equivalent, right? The names that we give them left and right are just names. So the Euclidean vertex is invariant under the gamma flip manifestly. In the Lorentzian one, it's a bit more hidden. So I'll start by defining some parity conjugation operations. Okay, so for a spinner, we have the J conjugation, which may look like this. And then for an SL2C element, the corresponding one would be to take the Hermitian conjugate and inverse. Okay, this is trivial for SU2. For SL2C, it reverses the boost. And now I want to say a few things about the unitary representations of SL2C that we're using here. So we have representations of the form PK. And well, first of all, the handy fact that are well known is that it's a self-complex conjugate, meaning that the characters are real, and that it's equivalent to the one with both signs reversed. Now, I want to flip the sign of gamma. So what I'm really interested in is in flipping the sign just of the boost parameter. Okay. So does this give the same representation? No, it doesn't, because we know that this is the only equivalence. But what I can tell you is that having this operation on the SL2C elements brings us from this representation to this one. Okay. First of all, this operation conserves the multiplication table. Right? The Hermitian conjugate reverses it once. The inverse reverses it twice. So it should bring us from one representation to another. You can convince yourself more or less geometrically that this reverses the boost, so this should reverse the parameter related to the boost. Formally, you can start looking at the representation explicitly as homogeneous functions of spinners, and then do these two substitutions, see what happens to the scaling weights, and that's what you get. So suppose I want to flip the sign of gamma here. The character will, in general, not be the same. But I can correct that by J conjugating all the SL2C elements. Okay, this does not change the integration measure, does nothing to the SU2 elements, conserves the multiplication order. So all in all, if I do this to the integration variables, I find that A gamma is indeed equal to A minus gamma. Okay. Now, some people of the mathematical persuasion might flinch that, you know, these guys are really divergent. It's not well defined, and so on. Well, it can be done with more pain if we write the convolution explicitly as a finite sum. It can also be seen in the coherent state language by J-ing also the integrated spinners and by interchanging the roles of the source and target nodes. A minor aside is that, in fact, Barrett's definition here turns out to be almost invariant under flipping gamma, aside from this gamma-dependent phase factor. Okay, and my conclusion from that is that one, well, the two definitions are not exactly equivalent, and two, that this one's better. It has a cleaner symmetry. So let's lose this. Okay. Yeah.
So gamma, this is the case of gamma real?
Gamma real.
unitary representations of SL2C characterized by two real numbers, a spin and a boost spin, gamma real, no special values on the real line, except for plus minus infinity where it goes to Barrett Crane and zero, which I'll talk about a little. I want to know what it signed as.
So help me, I'm being dumb here. What is the value of gamma for the Eisenstein connection?
Well, it's a free parameter, it's the same gamma.
Right, but if I take the connection to be the three Kristallnacht connection plus I times the spin of curvature, which is what we used to do, we call that the self-dual connection.
Yeah.
So which value of gamma does that correspond to?
I.
Right. So that's not the case that's being discussed.
No.
It's not any of the cases being discussed.
No.
Okay, thank you.
So is this good enough? Do we say that the new Lorentzian spin phones are parity invariant? Well, probably not. First, we should try and ask ourselves, what does parity transformation even mean? Applied to a boundary state, right? Saying a flip gamma of flip parity is just heuristics. What we really want to do is to say, here is an operator, looks like parity, we act with it on the boundary state, and it doesn't change or changes very simply the transition amplitude. So can we write such an operator? Well, I don't know how to do that, but I can try. Okay, and the very silly idea that one can do is, well, start with the basis where the boundary states are functions of SU2 group elements on the links. And complex conjugate this wave function. Okay, why would I want to do this? Because what it does is it won't change the expectation value of the configuration variables themselves, right? It doesn't change the modulus. It will flip, however, the expectation value of the canonical conjugate, which are the triad vectors along the links. Okay, and this makes some sense as a parity operation because these guys are rotation elements. They have two spatial indices. They should stay the same. These guys are vectors. They should flip. Okay, this is an anti-unitary operator. So instead of calling it parity, I really should be calling it time reversal, probably. I don't think we're smart enough to properly distinguish the two yet. Now, one thing I can say for it is that it commutes with the vertex amplitude, okay? Very simply because the representations both of SU2 and of SL2C that we're using are self-conjugate. So everything that we are doing to get from the boundary state to the vertex amplitude is real. Okay, so if the boundary state goes to its complex conjugate, so does the amplitude. So that's good. It also makes some sense in terms of the coherent state picture, because if I do the switch of basis and translate this operation into those terms, what I get is that all the spinners on the links get J conjugated, so all the face normals are flipped. And if I take a fully coherent state integrating over the different spins with these extrinsic curvature angles, so under complex conjugation, the extrinsic curvature flips, which it should also do under parity. So this makes a certain amount of sense. Okay. My problem with this, which makes me unhappy, is this part. Because the group elements on which the boundary state depends are geometrically not really rotations, right? We have the Ashtekar connection, and it's really rotations plus gamma times extrinsic curvature, okay? And under parity, the rotations are supposed to stay the same, but the extrinsic curvature is supposed to flip, okay? So all I can say for this is that this thing does behave as a parity operator, and then I can say that the story is fully parity invariant only when I can neglect this, that is, when gamma goes to zero. This is the a limit that people are beginning to like lately. I'll maybe say a little more about it in the end. But that's that. Am I good so far? Okay. So on general grounds, we don't have anything conclusive. So we can start checking specific calculations. Now, we can distinguish two kinds of parity violations in the theory. Right? If we have parity violations only as Planck scale corrections, then that's fine. That's a prediction. If we have them in the large distance classical limit, I find it much more troubling. The result which got me interested in all this is the work by Eugenio and friends on the large distance graviton propagator, which was not parity invariant, and the parity related components were different. So I decided to check whether that remains the case in the Lorentzian, which is the really interesting case. The answer is yes, that we're still in trouble. First things first. So there was some analytical work on the large spin four simplex limit, which is the simplest possible thing we can do to mimic large distance dynamics. For the transition amplitude or zero point function by the Nottingham group, and for the graviton propagator by Eugenio and Yu Ding. But because in the Lorentzian there are the infinite dimensional representations and there are these spinners to be integrated over, the analytical work is harder than in the Euclidean, and they all stop short of the question what happens for parity-related quantities. So I wasn't brave enough to do it myself, but I did do the numerics. In general, doing spin foams numerically should be terrible, because we need to integrate over a huge amount of variables. But in the large spin limit, what happens is that all of this beauty can be written in a stationary phase approximation. And then all we care about are critical points, the Hessian there, and so forth. And that is just doing algebra and derivatives. And doing derivatives, I can numerically. So where do we stand with that? So I expect that Eugenio told you a little about the whole four simplex technology. But in general, I can draw what the calculation is about like this, in one dimension less. So we want to triangulate a space-time region with a four simplex. In the Euclidean, they took a regular four simplex, which is easiest. In the Lorentzian, there is no such thing. The best thing there is an equilateral one. Right, to have a regular tetrahedron at the base, and then going into the time dimension, shorter side tetrahedron. So before folding, there is this sort of picture. Okay, this is the one at the base. These are the one on the sides, and then when we boost with the SO2C elements at the critical points, this closes up into a nice pyramid. And then the first question is, having written a coherent state peaked on this thing, what is its vertex amplitude. So what Barrett and friends found is that this reproduces the action of regular gravity. So there is some not interesting sine factor. And then two terms with plus the regular action and minus the regi action. Okay, and the weights of the two exponents are given more or less by the Hessians of the stationary phase. So something like that, times the measure factor, evaluated at the two points. And here they stopped, said we don't know the ratio of these two. Maybe one is dominant, maybe one is not. Now, these two terms are parity related. Okay, in the geometrical construction, they arise from the two parity-related ways to close this four simplex. Again, more properly, time reversal. You can boost the tetrahedron on the sides either into the future or into the past, and that gives the two terms. Also, the two exponents turn into each other under flipping gamma to minus gamma. So this is the interesting question for me. What is the relationship between these two guys? And the answer is...
Question.
Yeah?
So
So I understand why in the 2 plus 1 dimensional case, the Reggie action should be parity on, which is, I think, what you said. But are you saying the Reggie action is parity on in the 3 plus 1 dimensional case?
Reggie action is parity.
You said that the two terms turn into each other. Maybe I'm misreading.
The two terms turn into each, well, the action looks as sum over the spins, which are the areas, times the extrinsic curvature angles,
right?
And if you flip one of the axes, the angles flip.
And this is true in 3 plus 1 as well as 2 plus 1?
I think it is.
And if, okay, I that sounds right.
Okay. So in this case, the answer is a happy one. What we get is that the magnitude of the two coefficients is the same, and they are just complex conjugates of each other. Okay, this is not a proper analytical result, but it comes out very accurately in numerics over many cases, so I'm buying it. Okay. Now the phase in this relation is of course sensitive to the overall phase chosen for the boundary state, and here I'm using Barrett's canonical choice, which is that the source and target spinners should be related directly by the SU2 rotation that glues the faces properly to each other. Okay, and this is a sort of reality condition. Just a minute. So in light of what I said before about complex conjugation and how how it is transparent to the vertex, so I think this is a similar story, that we are starting with the reality condition for the boundary state and ending up with this, which says that the transition amplitude is real. Yeah.
So the formula on which you do a saddle point approximation to get this asymptotic behavior, is it explicitly real?
It's this formula.
Yeah, so is it explicitly real?
Well, it's certainly not real for any value of the size, right? Because you can throw, these guys are external parameters. They come from the boundary state, and they're complex. And it turns out that if their phases are cleverly related to each other, then the result is real. Now, this is such a simple-looking result that it has to be somehow easily seen analytically, but I don't know how.
So I'm just wondering, is it surprising that this formula is real, or is it not a surprise? Should they have expected it to be real or not? Because if it was clear from the beginning that it's real, then it cannot really be anything else. And if it's supposed to not be real, then I don't see how in the J limit you get something real.
Yeah. So the first of all, the vertex formula in the group element language is manifestly real if the wave function you throw in is real. So that much I can say. Okay, but the force influx calculation I'm not doing here. I'm doing it here. And here, I mean, I'm sure you are right that there is some obvious way in which the formula is real. I just don't see it. Okay, and one final small comment on this phase matching here, that it's also sensitive to the fact that I threw away this C phase factor, right? So throwing it away makes all the results nice. Okay, so what we have is that on the level of the 0-point transition amplitude, we're good. Things look parity invariant. In the Euclidean case, it looked even slightly better. There we had that n plus and then minus are equal and real. Okay, and in the Lorentzian, this is recovered in the gamma goes to zero limit. And there we are. Okay, anything about this? Right. Now, the sad part of the story, as in the Euclidean, is the graviton propagator. So what do I mean by a graviton propagator for the force simplex? No.
By the sad part of the story, you mean you're going to conclude that it's not parity invariant?
Yes.
That's happy.
I know you think that way, but I, so far I don't understand why.
That's related to stuff.
Okay. So yeah, you can just replace all in everything I'm saying. So the propagator is a creature depending on six nodes out of the total set of five in the force simplex. Okay, and this is the correlation of two metric insertions. Minus the not interesting part, where each of these is the scalar product of two vectors along the links. Okay? The way to calculate this guy in the stationary phase approximation is we write the metric insertions as derivative operators inside this integral with a little game that Eugenio is responsible for. They turn into algebraic insertions. And then this thing simply becomes inverse Hessian at the critical point times the derivatives of the insertions. Okay, and the I and j here run over all the integration variables. Okay, now in what I wrote here so far, the integration variables are the z spinners and the SL2C rotations at the nodes. Now, in a fully coherent state, we should also integrate over the spins. All right, and then this guy decomposes into two pieces. One comes from the variation of the spins, and the other from the other guys. And the piece that comes from the variation of the spins, now, equivalently, it means variation of the areas. Okay, this is the one that gives the Regge propagator. And this piece of the propagator scales with gamma as gamma cubed. And as the Regge propagator, it's parity invariant, and everything is fine with it. Now, the other piece is the one I'm interested in, and the one I calculated, where we don't know what happens. That is where Eugenio stopped analytically. And it scales as gamma to the fourth. Okay, meaning that again, the gamma goes to zero limit. This one dominates, and everything's fine. But I will insist on being interested in finite gamma to see what happens. Okay. Now, what is the criteria for parity invariance of this thing? Well, I should take two components. There's two sets of nodes which are related by a parity odd isometry. And because my four simplex is sufficiently regular, I can do that. So let's give them names. Okay, the base tetrahedron, let's call it 0. And the other ones go from 1 to 4, and they are all equivalent. And it's easy to convince yourself that any permutation among these four gives an isometry in spacetime, with even permutations giving even isometries and odd permutations giving parity odd isometries. So all I have to do is to compare, for instance, these two components, say 2, 3, 2, 4, and 2, 4, 2, 3. Okay, let's call this one G left, and this one G right. Okay. In the Euclidean, there was a very funny result about these two, which is that they are not equal. They are, in general, also not a complex conjugate. The R is gamma goes to 0, but never mind. But the ratio between the two is, for some reason, always a phase of 2 pi over 3. Okay, always is a bad word, because that the Euclidean calculation was only for a fully regular four simplex. Now, the surprising bit is that this remains true. Again, only numerically, but for high precision, to high precision and well tested, in the Lorentzian, and where the four simplex is no longer regular. Okay, so this two-thirds is something which is insensitive to the precise geometry of the boundary state. And I really don't understand where it comes from, but there it is. Okay?
Now, there's no gamma dependence.
Yeah?
There's no gamma dependence.
No, also no gamma dependence, not for the ratio.
Do they both go to zero when gamma goes to zero?
Yeah. They're both proportional to gamma to the fourth. Okay. So in the straightforward sense of the word, which I would like to see, parity fails. However, there is a relation between the two, which is this relation is when the two are evaluated at the same critical point. Remember, there are two parity-related critical points. So if we evaluate them at different critical points, then they are complex conjugates. I think that this fact corresponds to what I've been saying about the overall reality of the vertex amplitude. So if we buy the complex conjugation of the boundary state as parity, then this is parity invariance. But the fact that what I'm really looking for is this relation. In fact, if we take a fully coherent state and integrate over the spins, then only one of the critical points should survive. I don't care about the second one. So it's really these two that I want to be equal. So I take that as evidence that complex conjugation, though it leaves the vertex invariant, no, it's not really parity as I'd like to know it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you go from G left to G right if you permit two vertices, right?
Two nodes, yeah.
Yeah, two nodes. And so if you permit nodes three times around a loop, you should go back.
Right.
And so this into the 2 pi thirds is compatible with going right?
Of course, it's sometimes minus 2 pi over 3. And I guess I should have been clever enough to formulate when it's plus and when it's minus, but I wasn't.
And my question is, are you relating here parity with this discrete group that is just relational vertices?
What I'm claiming is that if you take a four simplex, and you can choose, say, a special coordinate system, right, where one tetrahedron is centered at a positive point on the x-axis, another one at the negative point, and the other three on zero. Okay, then exchanging these two corresponds to a reflection of the x-axis, and that plus rotation is parity. All right.
Can I have a question?
Yeah.
I'm really not an expert at all of this graviton calculation, but there's something which strikes me a bit. So you say that this graviton propagator is the Hessian at the critical point times QABM, QCDN.
The derivatives of these With respect to the integration variable.
So, but on the other hand, there are several critical points in this story. So what you call the plus and the minuses.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you pick only one of the critical points in that formula and not the contribution for both of them or something?
Right. You can take a coherent state at two different levels. You can keep the values of the spins on the links fixed and vary just the z's and the g's, and then you have two critical points. Okay, but then you don't get the Rege graviton propagator at all. You do get the correct Rege action for the zero-point function, but not the propagator. To get the propagator properly, you need to make the state coherent also with respect to the spins. Okay, so you integrate over the spins with a Gaussian weight and with a phase, and the phase is determined by the extrinsic curvature, which is the canonical conjugate of the areas. Okay, and basically at this stage, you are choosing a sign for the extrinsic curvature. And that leaves you just one of the critical points. So at the end, the graviton propagator is only interesting at a single critical point.
So why would you have the idea to compare the g right computed on the plus with the g left bar computed on the minus? So OK, they turn out to be equal, but why should I try to compare them if you tell me that I actually selected one, let's say the plus, and I always am there? I completely forgot about the minus stopped existing.
I was bored.
Oh, okay.
But other than that, I mean, this is the statement corresponding to the reality of the vertex formula, so it's a good sanity check. Okay. So I'm done talking about the things that I know. And I can talk a little bit about the about what we can do if we think that this is bad. Okay.
Just to clarify, what part of the results on the graviton propagator are you fitting in which are Lorentzian?
Everything I've written is true in the Lorentzian. This is true in the Euclidean as well. And about this, I don't know. OK. So one possibility is that this is happening simply because we're calculating the wrong thing, right? That the force simplex is far, far too crude. And to really compute semi-classical quantities, we should be taking very large, finely refined graphs with lots of spins. And then maybe it will wash out. There is one argument that I can give for what is definitely suspect in the force simplex calculation is that for the metric operator, I'm taking insertions at single nodes. Now, in the force simplex story, I really have no choice. But if we already know everything about LQG and we can calculate amplitudes for large graphs with the Planck scale resolution and so forth, and now I want a semi-classical graviton propagator, then it suddenly looks very weird to take a metric insertion at a single node to represent that. Because this is Planck scale stuff. It's sensitive to the discreteness and so forth. the semi-classical metric should correspond to quantities smeared over many nodes, I guess. So that's one reason to cast doubt on this. Now, it's also conceivable that we should, in fact, modify the theory to make it parity invariant. Now, the beginning of this project was that I thought that I can do that by flipping gamma in the vertex amplitude. As you've seen, that's empty, it's invariant. But there is a subtler possibility which could, in fact, modify the theory and maybe help, I don't know. And the idea is this, that gamma is usually taken as a global parameter. But really, it is used for each link separately. Right? For each link, we have either this trick or this one for raising SU2 into SL2C. So we can consider the following. At each link separately, rather than globally, take both gamma and minus gamma, and average over all the 2 to the number of links possibilities. Okay. Now my argument for invariance doesn't work anymore, because to show that the vertex is invariant under the sign flip, I had to change the integrated group variables, but these sit on the nodes, and I'm playing separately with the links, and it's entangled. So it could, in fact, modify the theory. A disclaimer about this is that it will not modify anything in the large spin limit, because Barrett tells us that in the large spin limit, stationary points exist only when the p's are proportional to the k's with the same proportionality constant everywhere. And that means that if I start flipping the gammas on all the links separately, in the large spin limit, all that will survive is positive gamma everywhere and negative gamma everywhere. And these, I've shown, are equivalent. Okay. Now, for large graphs with small spins, it could make a difference. Well, we should learn to calculate those in the first place anyway. I think I'm done.
Any more questions?
Yeah. Again, I'm also not an expert on this formalism with the graviton propagated
in
this way. In the original calculations, there's a spin dependence. There's an approximation of large spin, and there's a spin dependence, and that spin dependence becomes related to the space-time dependence of the propagator, at least heuristically.
With spin dependence, you mean the Gaussian weight factor for the integration over spins? You mean that G is proportional not just to, say, gamma cubed, but also to J cubed. This kind of thing?
That kind of thing. The statement that allowed people to make the claim that in the large spin limit, the graviton propagator is what we expect from classical relativity.
Right. So you're asking what is the spin dependence of the parity non-invariant piece?
Yes.
The same. Only the gamma dependence is different.
I see. So it's not that there's a leading order piece which is parity even, and a higher order piece which
is
parity.
Yes, there's a leading order piece in small gamma which is parity even, but not a leading order piece in large J.
Okay. So that the claim would be that you can only then make contact if we. I mean, when I say I'm happy to have parity invariance, non-invariance, I'm not. At leading order, we expect parity invariance because that's supposed to be the classical theory in the Einstein equation.
That was my point. Yes, that's what I said that. At Planck scale corrections, I'd be happy with non-invariance too. But in the large distance calculations, no way.
Okay, so this is problematic. Unless you
yes.
want to think that for some reason the theory is an expansion around zero, around gamma goes to zero.
And people started favoring that. I think Eugenio favors it. I still don't know what I think about that limit. I do know one thing, that when it's coupled to the large spin limit, I don't trust it too much. Because I like to take seriously the formula for black hole entropy. And if we believe that, and it says that the effective Newton constant in the IR, if we compare the LQG formula for the entropy with the Bekenstein formula, and it should be a numerical factor, and then gamma times the fundamental Newton's constant. So I think I believe that this should have to take place in the end, and in the large spin calculations, we don't see that. Instead, we recover exactly regiogravity with the same Newton's constant we started with. And so in the gamma goes to zero limit, these become infinitely far from each other. And I'm troubled by that.
That's an important
point. So other questions?
I just a comment. This gamma to zero limit suppresses a kind of fluctuations that are not there in regiogravity. These are torsional fluctuations, fluctuations that break the gluing between tetraedra. Mm-hmm. These are present in loop gravity, they are not present in regiogravity. And these are weighted with the inverse parameter. So the one possible logic is that we want a large region, so large J, but we want also that the typical quantum geometry fluctuations are smaller. Quantum geometry fluctuations go with gamma J. And so if you are taking J larger, also this gamma J is larger. So we have big fluctuations around gluing. So keeping the geometry fixed and sending gamma to zero freezes this kind of fluctuations. This is what we observe here.
Now, how much could this be an artifact of looking at just a few force indices and trying to get classical limit from large spins of a few force indices rather than trying to get the classical limit from many force indices with small spins?
I think it's good, except this. We are focusing on a single one and we want to suppress quantum fluctuations. And there are some that are automatically suppressed by large spin because you go to coherent states, but there are some others that are not suppressed.
Yeah.
There, just to your last argument, relating the renormalized value and the unrenormalized value.
Yeah.
Of Newton. I mean, what you would hold fixed would be a dimensionless Newton constant, anyways, and then you have a dimension there, so you would have m squared over m naught squared in front of the gamma IR. And so in that sense, I don't know if that makes any sense. In that sense, I see that probably if you take some really large, there's some really small value for gamma that that really takes and models the scale separation. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I mean, I naturally I would just hold dimensionless quantities fixed.
Okay, I didn't entirely follow, but okay.
I mean that doesn't help. That doesn't help with the mismatch that you.
The point is that there is a mismatch. It can be formulated in many different ways. So perhaps a more dimensionless way of formulating it would be like this. The entropy formula tells you that there is something like one bit of information per area quantum, okay, and the area quantum can be interpreted either as a Planck area or as the LPG area quantum, which is proportional to gamma. Okay. No, I think I tripped over myself all over again. Let's try it this way. The area in LPG, we are told, goes like gamma j times there should be something dimensionful here, and that is the definition of GUV. Okay, and in GIR you can define either by Newton's law at large distances or by the entropy formula, and then you find that there is a gamma ratio between them, because in the entropy calculation you get a bit per fundamental spin without the gamma piece, and you can twist it lots of ways. I'll probably be confused now. But there is a gamma discrepancy between the two things.
No, I don't doubt that. I'm just confused how to relate. I mean, I see. You just do in one case you compare Bekenstein entropy with discounting entropy of the isolated horizon. And they have a factor of gamma because the area is gamma. And then in the other case, you do this large spin asymptotics of a single four simplets or maybe a few, and you find that they exactly match. And I see that mismatch.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't, that's not what I'm questioning. What I'm wondering about is if I had a generic fixed point for G Newton, I would not want the fixed point for the dimension for Newton's constant, but for the dimensionless Newton's constant. So divided by some scale that has dimension mass squared. And that shows up somehow in this just creeps in through the back door when you compare Bekenstein entropy with some fundamental counting entropy. I mean, that's just a thought. I don't know if that makes any. That doesn't remedy the second part, the mismatch is the second part. It would just do something with the first part.
Well, I don't think there's any other scale which can creep in. I mean, the whole business with the dimensions is really a matter of convention, right? If we count everything with the discrete spins, we can just
go into that. If you have pure gravity without a cosmological constant, then you just have one scale.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't go curing it with the cosmological constant, right? That's a totally different scale. Or actually, maybe very small gamma, and that's the very small ratio. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Just, one idea about resolving this discrepancy is to get the semi-classical limit not in this kind of way, but through Ted Jacobson's argument about thermodynamics. And if one would go that way to the semi-classical limit and to the derivation of general relativity, then the physical inferential Newton would be the one that came from the black hole entropy by definition.
That sounds right, but in Jacobson's story, how can you fix the multiplicative constant for the entropy, which is really the point?
No, okay. Assuming that Ted's argument works whether or not that's been fixed, but assuming that that has been fixed in this way, in terms of in terms of the microscopic Planck area and gamma, then that would be the infrared Newton's constant that would emerge from that calculation, from that argument. And then, of course, what it does is it gives you a relationship between the emergency parameter and the ultraviolet Planck area.
We then
ignore these kind of spin foam calculations as being too microscopic, or not in the regime where the semi-classical limit is. But having said it,
you can do that. I think. I mean, the point still remains that the two have to be compared to see that.
But can I make a more general question? I mean, you looked at 0 point and 2 point function, but you could. I mean, you can keep going and study all kinds of observables. And generically, would you agree that that parity is broken for generic observables? That is, you happen to find that it is broken for these two-point functions, so-called. But the more interesting comment is probably the more lasting comment is just that there are observables which break parity in this formulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I should, in response to that, I should mention another important way in which the problem can go away. Single vertex calculations, no matter what the surrounding graph is, are suspect in the sense that the action that you're finding there is entirely a boundary term. Okay, and boundary terms can be changed in all sorts of ways without changing the actual classical dynamics, right? So what we should really do to see that there is a problem is to have more than one vertex with internal curvature on an with spacetime curvature on an internal face, and then if that is not parity invariant, then we're in trouble. And then, if you have one observable like that, which is not invariant, then then yes, you have to rethink everything. One is enough.
Yasha.
Yeah.
You were proposing something today refining the boundary instead of refining the inside.
Okay. Yeah.
And one can ask again about parity and its relation with something else that appears only in this simple case, it is permutation symmetry. You can exchange two nodes and ask what happens. And in this simple case, it amounts to parity. Now, we suspected that with Maglio and Perini, when we wrote this paper, mm-hmm. we suspected that these 2 by 3rds is due to the fact that to go from node to the same node going around links that connect them, you have to make 3 steps. Okay? Yeah. And in fact, this is related to the fact that if you permute 3 times, you get back to the same quantity in the same parameter. And we suspected that if you have a more refined graph such that to make a loop you have to go through many tetrahedra, you get not 2 by 3rds, but 2 pi over n, where n is the number of tetrahedra around.
Okay, so I missed that. That's good.
In the limit, this would be parity invariants plus corrections that are not parity invariants. And that's not bad.
Mm.
We don't have any example, any check with this idea.
Mm-hmm. No, but you can still, you can construct a regular enough geometry, so it has a reflection symmetry from many nodes, and then still exchanging 2 large subsets of these would be a parity transformation. And then now, if you claim that every pair of nodes exchanged gives a small phase factor, so that would again add up to the large phase factor. No? So it's the same thing.
Okay, are there more questions?
Okay, let's thank Yasha.